from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Woo-hoo! We are here. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. Today we have another exciting show lined up for you. We have the award-winning writer-director, Anthony Mindel, who is coming out with a new film that I don't think you've heard of yet, but I think you will. From the trailer, it is absolutely riveting, well-acted, exciting. It's thought-provoking, moving. The film is called Where We Go From Here. It follows three different sets of ordinary people and their lives, many LGBTQ, and then they each come into an encounter with terrorism of one form or another and how that affects them. The preview to it is up on YouTube. It looks astounding, and it's been through the award or the film festival circuit, and has won several awards there, and is about to go into a much more broad distribution where you get to see it. So that's exciting, and plus Anthony's whole approach to the art form is pretty intriguing, and we're going to talk to him about that. Before we get to that, I do want to touch on our new sponsor. We are proudly sponsored by the Los Angeles Blade. This week, the LA Blade hits the streets Friday, and it features RuPaul's new Netflix series, along with news from all over Southern California. And of course, it is written by the award-winning team of journalists there. Next week, The Blade is going to be celebrating its third annual Best of LGBTQ LA Awards. So we'll be on top of that. And if you want to party with the LA Blade staff, and you are in the Los Angeles area, they and their sponsors will be at Rocco's in West Hollywood, and that is located at 8900 Santa Monica Boulevard. For more information on the Best of the LGBTQLA or the party, visit the LosAngelesBlade.com website. You can also pick up your free copy of the LA Blade at the LGBTQ Center of Los Angeles, or one of the many paper boxes on Santa Monica or Sunset Boulevards. So definitely take a good look at that publication. It is one of the remaining strongholds of the LGBTQ prep. And if you're in the LA area, certainly you're acquainted with it. If you're not, check out the website. But we are proud to have them on board as our sponsor. And with that, I would like to welcome to the show my beloved co-host, Brody Levesque. Hey, Brody, how you doing?
Hey, Rob, good afternoon. Good afternoon, or good evening, or good morning, depending upon where you are to our listeners. Well, it's arrived. This afternoon in Washington at 2 o'clock, the President Pro Tem of the United States Senate, Senator Charles Grassley, Republican from Iowa, administered the oath to the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts. Justice Roberts then administered the oath to the Senate as a whole, and the impeachment court is now established, and the trial commences officially. So the trial process, an impeachment trial process for the President of the United States, Donald Trump, has commenced in Washington. There's still a lot of back and forth between the Republicans and the Democrats on the form, including witnesses that will be called, documentation, and things that both Democratic leadership and the House impeachment managers, led by California Congressman Adam Schiff and New York Congressman Jerry Nadler deemed critical to a successful evidentiary process for that trial. Speaking of which, earlier today, the Government Accounting Office, which is essentially a nonpartisan arm of Congress, it's a watchdog agency that looks out over government spending by virtually all branches of government, the courts, the White House, Congress itself, made a determination and released a memo this morning that the President of the United States had in fact violated the law by not releasing the funds to the Ukrainian government. In a summation, the Office of Management and Budget withheld funds from the obligation for an unauthorized reason in violation of the United States Code. We also question actions regarding funds appropriated to the Department of State for security assistance to Ukraine. With this decision, because it falls under Title subsection 684 of the U.S. Code, the White House essentially broke the law. In other words, the President of the United States did, in fact, commit a crime, which kind of takes away some of the thunder from certain members of the Republican Party who have been maintaining otherwise. Another couple of stories that we should probably touch on before we go to our guest. The FBI today announced the arrest of three men suspected of being members of a neo-Nazi hate group, including a former reservist in the Canadian Army. The gentlemen had weapons and were discussing apparently with undercover FBI types traveling to a pro-gun rally, which is to be held next week on the grounds of the Virginia Capitol building in Richmond. That gathering already triggered a reaction from Virginia's Governor Northam, who has declared a state of emergency and declared that weapons and so forth will be banned from the Capitol grounds. And that, of course, has touched out a rather large outcry from those on the right, and especially those that are NRA and other types of people who support that sort of thing. And then lastly, Florida and South Dakota. There is now legislation being proposed in both of those states that would essentially make medical transition of a child or even a social transition of a child be deemed child abuse. If a physician was to allow a child to transition between genders under these proposed pieces of legislation, the physician would be committing a felony and could be theoretically put in prison for it. This is a pattern that we've seen over the last few months. We've seen similar bills introduced into Kentucky, Tennessee, Georgia, Texas, and Alabama. These pieces of legislation appear to all have the same boilerplate language. South Carolina, too, I forgot family. They as well. And leading trans activists have told me that they see this as nothing more than an attack on trans youth. Attorneys from the American Civil Liberties Union and Lambda Legal agree with this. Shannon Minter, who is a friend of the broadcast, and I, of course, in transparency, are also good friends. Shannon is very alarmed by this because this type of legislation will cause a tremendous amount of damage to trans kids virtually all over the United States, but particularly in states that pass these types of legislation. So it's kind of a sad moment and a sad footnote as we start to move into the election cycle. So that's a basic summary of some of the top stories that are on my desk this afternoon.
Yeah, Brody, can you clarify that a little bit more on the bills? What exactly would be a felony? In other words, would the kind of the hormone blockers, the puberty blockers, or whatever, fall into that? And when you were talking about socialization,
yes,
would simply allowing a child to identify as their chosen identity and name qualify as that?
The
Where's the line that these bills are drawing?
They're drawing the line at if a doctor prescribes any kind of medical transition, which would include hormone blockers, that physician has committed a felony. If a social worker or a parent or a responsible party is taking note of the fact that the child is referring to one gender or the other, presenting as such, and is seeking medical transition and it is not reported, then they have committed a felony. Technically, if the parents allow the child to medically transition or take hormone blockers or the other types of medical necessary medications, they as well have committed a felony. These bills are essentially saying in short form that a child transitioning between genders to identify it correctly, that would be considered a form of child abuse in the laws of these states. The initial law that was first proposed came about as a result of a really nasty custody battle in North Texas, and Texas was actually the first legislative body to start to put together these bills, and it's just been kind of a ripple effect after that. Judging from the fact that the language is pretty much boilerplate, it's looking as though this is very much a concerted and organized effort by anti-trans forces in the conservative right that are pushing these bills, and they are getting these legislators in these legislative bodies to participate in getting these bills through. And the bills are picking up steam, and they are getting some traction. We saw a related bill passed in Tennessee a couple of days ago based on, quote, unquote, you know, religious freedom that would allow any agency to refuse, under the terms of religious freedom, the ability of a same-sex couple to adopt or foster a child. So these are the type of things that we are starting to see, and we're starting to see more and more momentum of it, particularly in the South and in that area of the country.
Yeah, although the Tennessee bill isn't the same as these other ones. I mean, it's an ignorant, stupid bill. What did it pass? Did it pass one legislature? I mean, both houses, where's that?
Well, Tennessee actually has two bills, one which is currently being worked on, which is the child abuse because of medical transition bill. That one still hasn't gotten out of committee yet. The bill that was passed and is now headed for the governor's desk for signature would allow basically discriminatory practices based on religious so-called freedoms in terms of foster care or adoption by same-sex couples. That bill is on its way to the governor's desk.
It's allowing different sub-agencies to discriminate, like, because
and
the foster care system,
yes.
In this, yeah, that's primarily where I would think it would occur, because the state agencies kind of farm out when they're above capacity to private agencies, and so it would give a private agency the ability to discriminate from there. I'm imagining is how that would work, but that's not a good thing, obviously. But these other ones are serious infringements, and I think all parents should be alarmed about them, because they're really intrusive in a much harsher way. And I think it looks like as happened before, these religious right people are following a legal pattern that they're trying to emulate something that was set up in another area, which is the closing down of conversion therapy. So it's an interesting but alarming set of circumstances that they have going there.
Well, I think that part of it has to do with the fact that they've suffered numerous defeats in the court system. But as most legal as most legal experts will tell you, that's changing. And that's changing as a direct result of this president and this Senate confirming to both district and circuit courts of appeals judges that are very anti-LGBT. And a very good deal of them are now sitting on the 11th and 5th Circuit Courts of Appeals, which is the South. So it will become problematic. And I think that it's a direct result of them losing the, you know, they've lost the fight on marriage equality. They lost the fight on open service in the military, save for the trans ban. So they've taken some hits. The conversion therapy, they've taken some serious hits on, because we're now up to, I believe, almost 16 states that have passed some sort of law, basically banning it completely. The last vestige, and I guess the last hill that they're standing on, and I warned about this in 2016, is that the trans community is going to be the ones at the tip of the spear, and that's exactly what now we are now seeing.
Yeah, that's very alarming, and yeah, we definitely need to get Shannon on the show and do a whole show on this. That's yeah, this is an important discussion. I want to transition though, because that's not what we're actually talking about today, and we've got waiting on deck the award-winning director and writer Anthony Mindel, and this film that he has just done looks absolutely astoundingly good, and can't wait to talk to him about it, which we will do right now. So with that, I want to welcome Anthony to the show. Anthony, welcome.
Hello, guys. It's a pleasure to
welcome.
Be here, and thank you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you great.
Okay, good.
So, Anthony, yeah, all I've seen of the film is the trailer, but the trailer definitely is incredible. I mean, it's the acting in it looks phenomenal. The tension in it is huge. It looks like just this majorly powerful film that you've put together. Where did this start for you?
Well, thanks for that. And I think, yeah, I guess a good, exciting trailer maybe entices people to see the full movie. So I'm glad that you were moved by it. I think, yeah, you can tell a story very impactfully in 2 minutes or 2 minutes and 30 seconds, but which is the length of a trailer. But I guess, you know, for me, they're just, it's basically three love stories that are intertwined. And I started writing after the, I think it was maybe the day of or the morning after the Pulse nightclub shootings. I had so much grief and anger around that and confusion. And I don't understand why this keeps happening. And obviously as a gay man, you know, it also felt so, I don't know, you know, like, you know, gay bars or gay clubs are such a sanctuary. It's the one safe space for gay kids and gay adults and people of any identity to go and have a great time. And so for somebody to infiltrate that space and murder people, no less, you know, just, I guess it was a very shock to the system. And so that happened on the day of the LA Gay Pride Parade a couple of years ago, right? 2016. And I just that morning, I didn't go to the parade and I didn't go to the festivities, and I just started to write my grief. I just had a lot of grief, and so I just started writing. And then from there, the idea came to me. So that's kind of the genesis of it.
And the other two components of the story, I'm assuming, are different encounters with terror violence, not parallel all to the same event. Is that accurate?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, originally what I set out to create, you know, I'm really interested in social documentary filmmaking in the sense that it's fictional. It's all fictionalized, right? But I do feel like the subject matter of the things that I'm writing are commentaries on what's happening in our culture or in a period of time, history, and really hopefully illuminates or reflects the human condition through that prism of, you know, to me, it's like social injustice that we need to talk about these things that are uncomfortable to talk about. So the other two stories were based on actual incidents. Again, these were all actual acts of terror or gun violence that occurred. But I wanted to just interweave them about sort of like being alive today, you know, modern love stories in a society in which that risk is, you know, common. So ultimately that's kind of how it all kind of came together. And I'm interested also in like their intertwined stories. And so I'm interested in sort of how our lives are often connected with people and circumstances and timing. Those are themes in the movie, which we may not even be aware of, like being at the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time. And you got on a train 2 minutes too late and you missed, you know, an event that could or could not have happened had you got on, you know, 2 minutes earlier. Or I'm dating this person is connected to this person somehow. You know, I think that is the magic of how we are all interconnected. And I think the ills of one culture are also bleed into and are affect other cultures. You know, I think it was interesting, if I could just say, like, all the news stories you guys were just talking about are so depressing at one level, but I also think, you know, America often leads, right, in politics and culture and media, and but we're also seeing America's effects in other parts of the world, like imperialism and right-wing nationalism and, you know, anti-immigration. And, you know, so it's interesting how we're all connected. So those are kind of themes that I'm interested in exploring.
Yeah, it's a lot of your work seems to be that along those lines where you take different stories and weave them in. Like you did a documentary, Some of Us, and that was kind of a similar point of view of that as well, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's a film we just finished as well. That's it has a documentary-esque feel. It's kind of like mixed media. It's very experimental, and it's kind of based on the I work with actors. I train actors, and I direct and teach actors, and so it's kind of like documents our work at our studios all over the world, but also there are fictional narratives, but it touches on mental illness and Alzheimer's and climate change. And, you know, but I want to say that also these things are not, it makes it sound like these stories are so depressing and nobody wants to watch them. And it's actually nothing can be further from the truth, really. Like I love Joaquin Phoenix and the Joker. I found that movie to be almost like it was so dark. And I really do believe in the light through the tragedies, that shadow is just an illusion, that it is ultimately all light. So for me, I have found that life is too tragic not to see it through the lens of a tragic comedy in a way. And I think, you know, for all of us going through all kinds of hardships, we also have moments of laughter and, you know, irony or absurdism that helps us survive things, right? So I actually feel like you mentioned that Where We Go From Here has been on the festival circuit, and we were mostly on the queer festival circuit this year, and we won some awards. But it's been interesting. I've gone to most of the cities where it premiered and screened, and to hear the audiences laughing, you know, at a lot of things was really joyous for me, because I'm just trying to show human stories that ultimately culminated in gun violence, but they're just life stories, right? So I don't want your viewers to think it's going to be like, oh my gosh.
Right. No, in fact, that's why I'm encouraging people to see the trailer, because the trailer does set that up well, that it is obviously some intense, real relationship things going on. And then towards the end of the trailer, you see these kind of life altering huge events that are shaking up these lives. And just, you know, you want to find out more, you want to see what happens, you want to see you know, what happened to them and what happens to them afterwards, and the acting in it. Like I said, it's, and to your point, it's only a 2-minute trailer, but it definitely takes you, you know, you are already dealing with people that are fully dimensional and wanting to find out more about them. Where can we see the film? Where can we get the film? And I think it's about to go into a broader release, isn't it?
Yes, we just got news today because we were working on this deal, but it's going to start streaming on Hulu. Yay! Starting February 1st.
Excellent.
Yeah, so you can see where we go from here on Hulu. It's only in the U.S. On Hulu, but currently it's also available on a number of other platforms, Google and Vudu and iTunes, you know, most of the traditional video streaming platforms. And also in the UK on Amazon, and also in Canada, iTunes and Amazon. So yeah, it's finding its way, but I think it's going to be exciting for American audiences also to be able to access it on Hulu, because I think a lot of people have that network. So.
Well, I definitely do, and I'm thrilled that that's the platform
Yay.
It's going to be
okay.
on. Yeah,
yeah.
It's like I can watch it on my phone, my TV, my computer, and I think even my watch if I was really desperate.
Well, I hope not, Rob. Oh my god, yes, I hope you get to watch it on a little bit of a, we shot one of the stories we shot in Paris, and it's, you know, Paris is so gorgeous, and I do think it looks really beautiful, so to see it on a bigger screen is really kind of magical, because it's a love story, and it, Paris looks like love, so hopefully you're not going to watch it on your little, on your iPhone, but
no,
but whatever.
I will watch
yes,
it on
I
my
appreciate
biggest
people.
Screen available. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's super, super exciting. Now, is the release of it going to qualify, or did it qualify for this year's Academy Awards, or is it just something we have to wait till next year to get that kind of recognition?
You know, it won't receive that kind of, it won't, because it did not get a theatrical release. So part of the requirements for Oscar consideration is you have to have a theatrical buy. And, you know, this is why Netflix does, they split the platform. So it oftentimes is a theatrical release while at the same time it's available on, you know, their streaming platforms. So they do
right.
that just so that, If it drops in a theater, even if it's just for a weekend or one day, it's qualifying for Academy Awards consideration. But at the same time, you know, they're making their money on its streaming content. So yeah, sadly, no. But hopefully maybe my next movie. I'm getting ready to shoot another movie. So hopefully.
That we'll hope that path opens up, because your work is obviously that caliber of quality. So, totally excited to see you move ahead there. Brody, do you have some questions?
Yeah, Anthony, let's talk a little bit about impact. One of the most important
yes.
things about filmmaking is impact.
Yes.
What was your goal as a director? What was your goal in telling the stories, all three of them, cumulative and in total when you're looking at the larger picture?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think I kind of answered that already, right? Where I think we're in all this together. I mean, is one of the big things that I also really believe in. And you know, I think social impact projects or films, to me, are hopefully the audience goes away thinking like, I don't have the answers for things. I feel like the movie is presenting questions and makes audiences think and hopefully makes us empathetic and do better. And like I said, it's really addressing issues. You know, when I wrote it, what's weird is when we've had the screenings, it feels even more topical and current now today under this current administration and what's happening here in the U.S. than when I wrote it, because it also deals with immigration, anti-immigration beliefs. So it feels very much today, and you know, it's especially maybe as an American, even though I'm not, I don't believe in nationalism, but I love what America stands for. And I love being here. My parents were immigrants themselves and emigrated here when they were in their 20s. And so I don't feel like I take for granted my life here. But I also think, you know, we could be doing better. I just think, you know, I mean, I could use this to go off on tangents, but how can we be the richest country in the world and we don't have socialized healthcare? It's just like, what an abomination, you know? Or what you were just saying about trans rights. Like, I mean, for these kids, it's just really unconscionable in this day and age that, you know, the government or state legislation wants to invade people's own personal bodies. It doesn't, it's just weird. And so I guess my hope is that people will see the movie and, you know, think about things. And also maybe it's a call to action. We have a call to action at the end of the movie about how you can get involved and, you know, help reform common sense gun laws, or like anything nowadays, like call your congresspeople. Like, it makes a difference to vote. You know, I did a project on climate change this past year, and it's also super funny, but then it's also really scary at the end, because again, why are we not more, I don't know why we're not out on the streets. I don't quite get it sometimes, that I think sometimes we're so complacent that we just don't care. And so I'm hoping that movies like this make people care.
Yeah, to your point, not out on the streets, which I think is a great question, is I honestly think we're overwhelmed. I think we started taking to the streets. I mean, you know, immediately after Trump was elected, there was a huge women's march, and then there were a couple other marches after that. And I think there was a point where it was like he wore us down. It's like we marched out kind of a little bit. And that's why I love what you're doing, because I think that being sparked from the inside and seeing a work like yours that realarms us, you know, it puts the fire back in to hopefully then start taking whatever actions are in front of us, which this year may be actually marching right out and voting. That's where the street may lead. One of the works that you got probably, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of awards and recognition was your film Birds of a Feather. What was that about?
Well, that was one of the first. It was a really small movie I did. It's about a group of actors. Again, it was kind of born out of the studio and my teaching, and they're trying to put on it's like a ragtag group of actors who aren't really making it professionally and try to put on a production of Chekhov's The Seagull, and everything that could go wrong goes wrong. So it's like a comedy of errors, and that's also available on Amazon now. And you know, it kind of got me started with my filmmaking career. And I actually had a short many years ago, which is the first thing that I did that was on the festival circuit. And then I sold it to the Logo Network at the time when Logo was kind of still around and buying content at that time. And it's a short story based on my life as a young gay boy growing up in the Midwest. And I wanted to be a cheerleader. And so it was on the festival circuit, and it was a huge success. And, you know, I guess as a queer filmmaker, I'm just trying to bring light to the varied stories that we all live. And, you know, at some level, I think as a writer, all the characters are me at some level, and I'm just kind of working through my own issues and my stuff through the circumstances, the scenarios that I'm writing. And thankfully, I guess they seem to be universal, that people can relate to them. You know, I always say the micro is the macro, the things that each of us is feeling, pain and heartache and love and loss and hope and, you know, fear, like it's universal. Like, I think sometimes the challenge with human beings is that we're not taught how to actually sit in or allow those feelings. We run away from them, and then also we project them onto other people. So, like this again, the legislation that you were just mentioning at the top of the show to me is a projection of people's fears. It's a projection of people's mm-hmm. wanting to control things that they don't understand, but they can only control it by, you know, passing laws that, you know. So I feel like it's really about unexamined feeling, really. I've been working with actors for over 20 years, and a lot of it is really getting people to connect to the uncomfortable aspects of what it means to be a feeling being. And I think that's where our culture is kind of going awry, you know?
Yeah, no,
it's very,
very
difficult
very
to
true.
Have.
In fact,
it's difficult. Sorry, I was just going to say, it's difficult, you know, the head of our country he's not an empath. You know, some would go so far as to say he's a sociopath. But whatever the case is, he definitely does not seem to be a very compassionate, loving, empathetic person. And I think that
right.
from the top down, it's showing young men in particular, and young men already have a disconnect from feelings. We're not taught culturally how to feel. And so a lot of times, I mean, there's been a lot of social science that shows that ends up resulting in violence. Whether it's gun violence or physical violence or domestic abuse, to me as a teacher of feeling, I can kind of trace how it's about the repression of it to such a degree that eventually it explodes. I always say everybody should take an acting class because I think it would make us much more sensitive human beings.
I totally agree because I actually did that. That's was when
oh,
I was
great.
A theater major in college, and my intention was to be an actor, and I was part of theater groups in LA years ago before I got diverted in different directions. But I always felt that the acting talent or acting not strategy, but
the technique of acting, yeah.
Craft.
Technique.
But it was more than a craft. Yeah, it was something where I found it was a way that I learned to step into other people's shoes. And to your point, heighten a skill of empathy on a deep level, where I was becoming so empathetic that I was being them for this short period of time. And
yeah,
there were
exactly
huge
right.
lessons in doing that. And I did want to ask you about that because one of the things that you have done is you have trained some of the top talent in Hollywood, and you have schools that you've launched. And part of that is you have adapted and evolved insights about creativity into these crafts. How is that structured? What is your strategy and technique that you teach?
Yeah, I think it's really the science of feeling in a way, like kind of what you said about what you learned in your acting class. I feel like a lot of the stuff that I have been influenced by over the years, besides philosophy and spirituality, science, and science and spirituality to me are kind of sisters, and that they kind of lead us to the same place. And for me, I think there's a science in creativity of mostly what I'm trying to help all artists, not just actors, is to not let the left brain. I have a book called At Left Brain Turn Right. And although our brain cannot be reduced to just, oh, left brain means cerebral, analytical, linear, and right brain is creative and impulsive and artistic, I mean, we understand those things as a metaphor, and at some level, those spheres do activate those parts. But I know that the brain communicates back and forth, and we need both parts. So I'm not suggesting, oh, you should only be a right brainer. But I guess my point is I find that for everybody on the planet who is an artist, most of the time their head tells them they're not, and so they don't pursue it, or they don't act on it, or they don't write or create or sing, or they get stuck in a position or a profession or a lifestyle that brings them no satisfaction or joy or, you know, sort of spiritual awakening. And I think that we all are artists. Everybody's an artist at some level. And how we see the world is artistic, right? So I feel like if training helps support opening up that portal, that's kind of, and that's a science, and that's a craft, and that's spirit. And so I'm kind of working a lot of different modalities to help people mm-hmm. step into, you know, their potential, really.
So when you work with somebody who is specifically working on the craft of acting, what is the approach? They have a character, it's written out. Where do you take them to make that character three-dimensional?
Well, I mean, I think the thing, the great maybe mystery about acting is we don't, it's very difficult. We have these concepts and words and theories and terms to use it to help guide somebody, to help tell a story. But ultimately, just like being alive, it's just all mystery, right? But I think there's this common misbelief that people are playing characters. And my philosophy is that, yes, you're going to see a movie and you're seeing the movie of, you know, George and Martha, let's say, in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, right? You're seeing
right.
those characters,
right.
that's their names. But really what it is the human being who is playing that character, it's all the human being. So it would be all you. And that our acting philosophy is we're just trying to get the human being to reveal more and more parts of themselves. And I find it interesting that people sometimes dispute that. They're like, no, I'm nothing like that. That's the character. But even if that's the case, like even if I don't live my life every day, like if I were to play Donald Trump, yes, I'm not. Well, that's autobiography. I mean, that's based on a biography, but maybe not the best example. But even if I were to play somebody that I don't think I am, who's playing it? I'm playing it. I ultimately am the actor. So I have to find it. And I can't find it anywhere but in myself. I can use my imagination. I can go study people. I can, if I'm basing it off of a real person or something, I can watch tapes and mimic it. But then ultimately, it still comes through me. So I think mm-hmm. that's the great aha that's starting to happen, that it's not, we think Meryl Streep is playing a character. Meryl Streep is really playing herself through this character. So that to me, and I also think that that has, you know, sort of the connotations of life itself, is that we try to do so many things to run away from who we are. And whether we have more money or more nice clothes, or we drive the right car, we take these vacations, or we win, you know, titles of power. In many ways, I think our seeking culture of like trying to grasp and grab so much stuff is also about trying to get away from who we are, because we're not taught to love who we are and accept who we are. And yet we're all just all on our own individual journey on this planet, aren't we? So that's
what absolutely.
I think. It sounds pretty deep, doesn't it? It's pretty cool.
No, it sounds wonderful, actually. It sounds really worthwhile, whether you end up actually going on a stage or in front of a camera, just, you know, going through the process. It sounds pretty enlightening and self-informing, even if you, no matter where you go with it. I wanted
yeah.
to switch gears a little bit based on what you were just saying, though. When, you know, one of the big things that have come out under discussion in LGBTQ circles and the LGBTQ circles that are intersecting with the theatrical Hollywood world is whether people who are not LGBTQ or not gay but playing gay or not transgender playing a transgender character, what are your feelings about that, or does it matter?
Well, you know, here's the great thing is that I think we're now living in a time, I think, certainly in our industry, where it's more for all comers. And so there are more trans roles available. I mean, we have such a long way to go, so don't get me wrong. I'm just saying this, you know, I'm looking at the positives. So, you know, when I've been in the business, like I said, for maybe 25 years now, and, you know, there was maybe one trans role every 25 years. Remember that movie, The Crying Game? But that wasn't even like a trans character.
Right.
I mean, that was a trans character, but that Jay Davidson, I think his name was. I can't believe I'm remembering this.
Right.
But, you know, that was played by a straight male actor, whatever. And but I guess my point is we're starting to see queer identities and transgender characters or, you know, fluid non-gender characters who don't necessarily even have to address their identity, right? And I think that's great. And I think, like, I think now that there are more of those roles available, we're going to start to see more trans actors and undefined gender fluid people playing those roles, because I think it's just like anything. If there are none of those roles being written for you, you're not going to pursue acting. But I think now there's more and more of those people coming into the business. Right. So, yeah, I think like the gay and straight thing, I don't know. I think acting is also always going to be acting. So I don't mind it also, though. I mean, that might be controversial. Like, I just think it's like whoever is the most right for the role in a way. So if I'm gay and I'm really right for this straight role, I think the problem is it's only one-sided, right? They don't let gay people play quote-unquote straight roles. Maybe that's changing. And it used to just be all straight people would play gay roles. So I'm hoping that's starting to really become not an issue. But,
I think there are crossovers on the gay to straight. I mean, Matt Bomer played, you know, straight in the television series he was in. I mean, he was a straight character, there are actors doing that. And also some of the breakthroughs I love seeing, for example, in Ryan Murphy's The Politician, one of the characters in it is a straight cisgender male, but is played by a transgender actor.
Addressed as
he's transgender. He's not, you know, it's like he is simply playing a cisgender male role. And I think a lot of the actresses in Pose could easily play cisgender female roles. I don't think they have to be defined that way. So it's just an interesting discussion, and I'd love your insights on it, particularly since you're coming to it from a inner psyche, you know, collaboration with the craft itself, which is, I think, fascinating.
Yeah, I think, you know, no matter what I do with actors is, you know, when they're cast in a role or they're working on a role in class or whatever it is like, how do we bring all of their authentic self to what that role is asking? And that's an always deeper and deeper exploration. And there's no end to that depth. And that's exciting. Like, I think, you know, I think sometimes we don't realize how deep we can be as human beings. We think we know ourselves, but there's, like, I think, galaxies and solar systems within us that we don't even uncharted. Sort of based on just like roles, one of the cool things is we partnered with OutHus last year, and our school here in LA offered six trans scholarships last year, which was a really great inspiration for the recipients of the scholarship and also their classmates at the school, where, you know, trans actors applied and they were admitted into school and they were part of the program, and some of them are working out professionally, and to just be given opportunities where they would normally not has been really exciting. So I hope Hollywood keeps writing roles and rethinks about the casting of it, you know?
Right. Well, I hope you keep writing roles, because I love just your insight on things, because just what you were talking about writing about somebody's, like, the legislatures behind these bills and the fears that are going on inside them, to me was somewhat fascinating, because I could totally see a piece where that character is written out, you know, with the fears and the sincere reasons they're so threatened and writing and out there, you know, fighting their fear with this legislation. And juxtapose that to a parent with a child, you know, and I've talked to several of these parents where the child is 3 or 4 years old and adamant that they are not the gender that everybody thinks they are. And the terror in the parent that if they don't honor that, they know that the statistics are that that child could become suicidal and deal with a lot of mental illness and all these things. Whereas if they support it, that child's chances of falling into that is dramatically less, and their chances of living a completely balanced, normal life. And to juxtapose the two psychics of those two people on the opposite ends, I think would be a fascinating thing to look at. But
Well, I think you just hit on the heart of compassion and empathy. Like, you know, I'm not condoning, or we shouldn't idly sit by and let, you know, oppressive laws or prejudice or whatever go by. But I do think it is interesting when you can sort of get a more bird's eye view from it. You see, oh, okay, what is driving somebody's fear to react that way? And most people that are reacting like that are so unconscious of it. It's just become habitual. And so, you know, it's just, I think it's just a more fundamental way of being human in the world. That's all. I think we've kind of passed the point in our culture now politically where that's not even possible anymore. I don't think everybody says we have to, you know, get together and meet on common ground. I don't know. I don't think that's possible anymore unless you look at it through the prism of compassion, you know?
Well, yeah. And I think your point of view is really interesting in that common ground doesn't mean a place where we agree on the same things, but it common ground may be what you're talking about in terms of recognizing that the other person has fears. And we have fears, and we both have fear.
Yeah.
And if we know that, and we come together and go, okay, let's put our fears out and see which one of these are real, and maybe help each other through our fears rather than attacking each other, that may be a more progressive way of dealing with it. So it even calls into question the oh, don't tell me. But you're changing the paradigm is my point. That in a really potentially helpful way, because maybe we're looking for the wrong thing to try to find compromise or meeting of the minds on. It's more of meeting of the hearts, the mm-hmm. fears and loves, rather than meeting of the intellect and, you know, that type of thing.
That's exactly right.
Anthony, you talked about a next project that you're working on. Can you share a little bit about what that is and what direction you're going in?
I mean, if there are any financiers who are listening and you want to contact me, I mean, we have part of the money and, I have many, many different projects in, kind of all phases of development. And interestingly, most of them are very women-generated, women protagonists, and it's really a woman's world that I'm interested in. It's based on a historical time in communist East Germany in the 1970s, and when the swim team, the national swim team, was given male growth hormone and testosterone, these young girls, to prove that communism was superior to capitalism and win the sort of gold medal race in the Olympics. And we know now that this story 40 years later is still look at Russia. They again are being banned now from the Olympics in Tokyo this summer because they have systemic doping. So this is kind of the mother of all doping stories. It's kind of where doping began at such a regimented, structured, systemic place, and more than 10,000 female athletes were affected. So, I'm really excited about the story. It's very scary and beautiful. It's a coming of age story, and it also just deals with the sort of politics of young girls' bodies, the politics of sport, the politics of, you know, communism versus capitalism or democracy. So we're very close to starting production. So I'm really excited. So that's kind of what's on my plate right now.
Yeah, no, that sounds incredible. Are you, there's a, you know, one of the things, especially if you talk to more right-leaning people on the issue of transgender folks, it's a bit of a red herring because there's not all that many of these people, but they are very worried about transgender women who, you know, come from a, you know, male biology in theory, participating in sports. Will that have any overlap in your new project at all?
I mean, you know, it's interesting because there is a story. We are thinking about casting maybe a trans actor in one of the stories because there was some sexual conversion, right? Transitioning from, there's a famous story of a shot putter who was 18 years old, and was given so much, like, you know, 100 times more testosterone than even a man should be getting. And eventually later in life, she converted to male. She lives her life as a male. Although there was no, you know, internally, she had no desire to transition. She just eventually, she had to because of, like, from a, so psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, she did not feel like she was a man, except for when she was taking the steroids. And eventually, it's just her body converted based on the hormones. You know, I know that they passed that, the track and field governing body passed that new rule banning Caster Semenya, who was the runner from, I'm sure you guys know, she's won the last like three Olympics in the women's 800, but her testosterone level is higher than what they are now establishing limits for women, their testosterone readings for competition. So she has basically been banned from running in her winning race. She can't run in the 800 anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, and she's been fighting it all the way to the court of arbitration in Switzerland, which is, I think, the highest court of sports arbitration. But she's lost. So she's being punished for basically biologically her body just being what it is. So I don't know. Maybe
right.
There needs to be like an intersex race or, you know, a whole subgroup of, you know, I don't know. I mean, why can't it be?
Or changing just the perception of this male-female binary category thing,
that's right.
And looking
that's
at
right.
more what it is in the spectrum. We are unfortunately down to our last 2 minutes here. This
we
has been absolutely
deep,
fascinating and wonderful. We went deep. So, Anthony, what haven't we asked you about that we should have?
I mean, no, I think you guys asked me everything. I mean, if people want to, you know, hear more about me, or obviously I told you guys where you can watch the movie. Like I said, it's coming out on Hulu February 1st, but it's on other platforms. It's called Where We Go From Here. And if you want to find me on social media to keep, you know, say hi or ask me questions, or, you know, I'm available. My name is Anthony Mindel, and our schools are Anthony Mindel's Actor Workshop, and we're in 9 cities all over the world. So I'm sure you can find me somewhere. Just Google me.
Excellent.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's been absolutely fantastic. I want to thank Brody for being on. I want to thank our listeners. I also want to highlight that we can also be heard on Out in Santa Cruz this Saturday night, and you want to hear it because my guest on that show is Catherine Lejeune, who is the producer of Where We Go From Here. So we're going to continue the conversation with her on Saturday, and that can be heard live stream on www.ksco.com. I want to thank Anthony so much for everything you do. Your artistry, your everything you're bringing to it is super, super exciting, and I hope a lot of people see everything you're working on. And check out Hulu on February 1st, and you can see this great film from there, and there we go. We'll be back again next week with more Rated LGBT Radio. So for Brody and myself, we wish you goodbye.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.